last meeting on state federal affairs, come to order, clerk, call a roll, please.
President Ford.
Here.
President Gilmore. President Kennedy.
Here.
President Simpson.
Here.
President Wyatt.
Here.
President Brown.
Here. We're going to first hear from Representative Johnson on House Bill 2795, well drilling violation. Welcome to committee, Representative Johnson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sam Johnson. I represent Chute Klamath County. As you may know, some of you who visit us occasionally, we have a great deal of well drilling in our area. There are many, many homes, most homes, in fact, that have their own well. And we have found that try as we will, throughout the state for a number of years, and the state engineer has been active in his staff, we have a hard time keeping the illegal wells from being drilled. It's a sad situation for the residents, the consumer, and it's a dangerous situation in some cases where the wells are drilled in connection with or adjacent to or in some related fashion to the sewerage arrangements that we have in that area. This particular situation is finally, at long last, putting some teeth into the laws that we have had about catching and prosecuting these illegal well drillers. I won't go through the whole bill. You had testimony on it before. State Engineer Chris Wheeler is here, willing to and ready to answer questions. I simply have met with him and some of the legitimate and cooperative well drillers, and they are at a loss to protect themselves and the public. We find rigs set up, but we can't get them actually drilling. They see the state cars or the state people, even if they're in unmarked cars, coming in, and the driller disappears in some cases. This will allow the state engineer and his agent to set up a citation arrangement. And I think it will go a long way in stopping the illegal drilling. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there questions? Representative Johnson, may I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Thank you. The first question is concerning illegal well drilling activities. That's is there current licensing of well drillers?
Yes, there is.
There is. And these are what? Then people that are not licensed? Is that it? Or?
That is right. Are suspended for one reason or another. There is, present people are licensed. They have to make reports on the cores that they have and a number of other matters Mr. Wheeler may be able to assist me with now.
Right. Mr. Wheeler, why don't you join Representative?
Thank you very much, Jim. What are the requirements for licensing?
Well, the requirements for licensing is that they be 21 of good moral character, they pass an exam, and pay the fees, and for a machine operator, have had 52 weeks of training in actual operation of machine or its equipment. Representative Johnson has run through this pretty good here and has also answered your question fairly well, but there is, in addition, sometimes people who are licensed who don't follow all of the requirements, even though their well may not be totally illegal. This is a tool to get their attention easier from both standpoints, both the drillers and the state engineer.
I noticed all the people who appeared on our previous hearing, Representative Johnson testified in favor of this bill, mostly well drillers, by the way. So apparently there's some other people who are then drilling wells and they're drilling wells that are not according to certain specifications or state standards. I'm wondering what those might be. In other words, what I'm trying to get at, I suppose, is who are we after and why are we after them? Aside from the fact that they're not licensed.
In Deschutes County alone, how many legal well drillers would you hazard a guess? I would say there are 10 of them, maybe less than that.
So maybe
7 to 10. And how many illegal? I would say at least 4 or 5.
4 of them that are...
Yeah. And Chris has been there, Mr. Wheeler has been there repeatedly and has written them letters, has stopped and seen them, has threatened to confiscate their rigs, but has to take them to court and prove that they actually were the operator that was drilling that well at that time and did this and that wrong. This, of course, would make it a citation situation. They could admit that they're guilty, pay a fine, and there's a series of civil fines listed, or deny it, as we do in our speed tickets, and ask the engineers to take them to court and hopefully defend themselves.
I see. I'm wondering, what are the abuses, aside from the fact that they're not licensed? Where they're drilling the well, or are they not casing the well, or they're...
I'm curious, you know, what are we protecting the public from? Besides the fact that he isn't licensed.
I think maybe I could answer that better than Grinnell. Lack of casing, either in the quality of the casing, using substandard casing, not enough casing, not deep enough, not sealing the well, put the casing in without making any proper seal around it to prevent the passage of either sewage or waste effluent or whatever it may be on the surface, rainwater, into that water body. And in many instances, these are for domestic wells that they're being done and aren't there. They're running, I hate to use the word fly by night, but anyway, a quick operation in and out for a less fee and not an adequate job. And then the well pumps mud, they can't clear it up, and it doesn't test free on the bacterial test count because of the lack of casing seal on it. And that's the most critical. That's the worst problem that we actually have associated with. There are many others. There are the crooked holes and cave-ins and improperly developed and a lot of other things. But the most critical is involving either the amount of casing that isn't going deep enough to do the job, or it's lightweight stovepipe that's breaking and fracturing, or it's old stuff that's got rust holes in it and they can't weld it up tight. And then on top of that, not putting a seal around it.
So then two things are happening. One is you're giving the licensed, well-qualified welder, driller, a black eye, and the second thing is public protection as far as sanitary wells and or whether or not you're going to be able to keep a well there for a while.
That's right.
All right. Sure. Representative White.
Chris, what's the fee for getting a consultant?
It's 25 plus another 20 about that adds on to it for a bond.
For
initial. And then afterwards, the renewal is $20 a year.
Yeah.
Oh, no. You're looking at less than $50 a year as far as the cost of doing this.
Yes, Representative White.
The primary problem are the illegal wells. How about the placement of those wells? They're all still problems, for instance, too close to the drainage, stuff that can drain the field,
that is correct, Representative Wyatt. They're also, they're running quick. They're making a mistake in one. They do place them close to septic tanks and drain field lines, as well as not properly sealing them. And of course, that just compounds the problem. If you had it all out by itself, maybe a lack of seal wouldn't always be critical, but it's close and it is tough.
But they don't have to get permission from you to drill to get rid of their first well.
Well, they are required to not drill it within 100 feet of the main field or the septic tank by the rules, yes.
What I'm getting at is after they strike water, then in order to use that water, they have to go through your office, do they not?
That's correct.
No. Okay. Representative Wyatt, another question. Then Representative Hammond.
Do you know legal well often result in over-appropriation of the water source?
No, that's not the problem here. Maybe occasionally, but that isn't really what we're worried about.
Everybody were licensed and you had decent water.
That's correct.
Giving better control.
It gives better control and less of a problem.
Especially in Klamath County, which is so soon.
Right.
Terrible problem, Klamath County. That's true, I've heard that. Well, and Baker, Wheeler, Grant, Harney. Representative Hanneman?
I always forget, Chris, do you need a license to dig a well on your own property as a landowner?
No, Representative Hanneman. You can do that without. You are required to follow the standards and you're required to post the bond.
If I dig a well on my neighbor's property and he pays me for the hours I spent doing it, I need a license.
Then you need a license. Yes.
So this bill doesn't apply then to digging a well on your own property.
By yourself, that's correct. It does not.
We can assume that there's no impact on commercial marinas.
I'm always hesitant about this.
Representative Stepson, before we get over to commercial marinas.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. Chris, I don't know if you intended it. I took one of your statements, something about a crooked hole. You can't issue a citation for that, can you, Bill?
No, sir. We could not.
Did you mention that and you were saying some of the problems?
I added to some of the problems that we have, or that the people have there, of a crooked hole. And well, that particular function isn't something we would address directly or issue a citation for. some of these people that are operating illegally are causing more of the crooked hole problem, and if we get them under control otherwise, that'll improve the quality too. Now, we're not have the authority to issue a citation on crooked hole.
Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Members of the committee. Okay. Members of the committee, we have a set of amendments also to House Bill 2795 that are noted as committee staff amendments April 20th, 1975, which basically all they do is add some other sections, is that correct, to the bill, or subsections of the bill, which are the administrative appeals process. In other words, there was no appeals process through the penalty. Should have them right there in your bill or right by your bill on 2795, committee staff. And what they would basically do would be to refer back to Chapter 183 as your appeals process.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Wyatt.
I'll move the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wyatt. Representative Wyatt moves the amendment to House Bill 2795, dated April 28th. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye. No. Just the standard language as prepared by legislative counsel about how to have a hearing.
No. No.
Aye. 1, 2, 3.
I'll change my vote to aye for, thank you, Reverend, purposes of the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman,
well, I'm wondering if we don't have four votes on the bill, and I'm sure that's why we don't have it. If we don't have four votes on the bill, there's probably no sense in taking a motion to pass the amended bill out. I think we had another explanation by Representative Johnson on the bill.
I was outside the door.
Did you catch that explanation?
Yes, I did.
All right.
Confirmed my opinion. Thank you.
All right. Which is a further penalty further penalty on unscrupulous well drillers.
Never knew one.
I never either. I suppose that's a good way to hour maybe to meet a few.
Well,
just for the record, you'd like
the record.
Representative Wyatt moves House Bill 5 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion on it. Clerk, call roll.
Aye.
Nope.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Got that gavel down in a hurry.
Chairman.
Representative Gilmore.
I'm sure we noticed that I'm probably going to have to fight the bill on the floor.
Sure, that's fine. Any further discussion, vote explanation? Representative Wyatt, would you chair that on the floor, please? Or would you like to
note
in Klamath County, Representative Wilhelm?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman?
Would either one of you like to carry this bill?
I'm going
to
give it to Sam.
Sam, you want to let Sam to carry that? All right, come on.
Give
it to Representative S. Johnson, then, if you'll take it. Okay, let's move to House Bill 2805. Oh, that's right next door. That's handy. Okay, we amended the bill the other day, which really, in essence, made a new bill. Deleted all the previous bill and inserted the following. Section 1. All agreements between a wholesaler and any author, agent, or representative of any brewery for distribution or sale of malt beverages shall be in writing. Such agreements shall include but not be limited to the following. A, all reasons for which either party may terminate the agreement. B, the amount of notice required by either party to terminate the agreement. C, the term of the agreement and conditions for renewal. And that's all that it says now. Quite a departure. Quite a departure from the original bill.
Is this a Coos County bill?
No, I think it now is. I think it probably applies to a lot of people. You all, incidentally, just had to hand it out to you, a bulletin, National Beer Wholesalers Association of America. Chicago, Illinois, Cicero Avenue. It sounds like something out of the days of 1920s. For immediate relief, anyway, it notes that the U.S. court enjoined Olympia from dropping Ham's wholesaler in Minnesota. Thought you might bring that to your attention. It mentions incidentally a Minnesota Franchise Act. I wish we had a copy of the Minnesota Franchise Act.
Oh, I understand the state landlord is closed, so.
That firms up my support for the bill, Commissioner.
Very good. Representative Wyatt, do you have a motion on, the bill? Thank you. Representative Wyatt moves House Bill 2805 to the floor of the two pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
President
Gilmore.
Aye.
President Hanson.
Aye.
President
Wilhelm.
No.
President
Wyatt.
Aye.
President
Hanson.
Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 2617, I just had some amendments, unfortunately, just presented to me, so I'd like to wait until our next meeting to bring those amendments to you. There's some amendments by the private clubs regarding that bill.
I was just questioning whether they were minor, because I know my assistant ran down quite well.
Yeah, they're 2465.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, these are 2617.
Okay, I apologize.
And I just had some with a suggestion concerning the dispenser's license on a daily basis and a daily fee, and I'd like to have a chance to go over those if we could. So let's turn to House Bill 2465. Representative Gilmore,
I'd like to move the amendment dated May 7th.
What do they do?
Well, we'll move the amendments and we'll discuss them while we do that. Would you like to explain your amendments before we move them?
No.
Representative Gilmore moves his amendment to House Bill 2465, dated May 7th, 1975. Any discussion? Representative Wyatt.
I'd like to know what they do. It's kind of tough to.
Honestly, page 3 deletes almost all page 3 appears.
Yep. Actually, what it does is it from. Go ahead, Dan. You better at it than I would be.
All right, Representative. Sorry.
Well, what the original bill did was if the OLCC determined that discriminatory action was taking place, it could suspend the liquor license. What these amendments do is transfer that investigation to the Bureau of Labor, who is currently involved in investigating discrimination cases. And if the Bureau of Labor, through its process, determines that discrimination exists, then the OLCC could suspend the license. But it takes the OLCC out of the investigative role in this hearing.
But you're a man.
Yep.
Question.
Further discussion? I gotta see what they do here. Further discussion. Clerk, call and roll.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. What?
Oh,
that's all right. We haven't moved the bill yet, so you still can do that. Alright. Okay, the amendments are adopted. Any other motions on the bill?
Move
to table. Representative Wilhelm moves that we table amended House Bill 2465. Clerk, call roll.
Yep.
No. Motion fails.
I'm in support of the
recommendation. Okay. Representative Wyatt moves House Bill 2465 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion?
I'm not sure we should have done it the way it means or labor. Because you're going to involve a labor commissioner in the
Representative Gilmore.
No, now I know what you have in mind, but you know that is not a bad idea to a point. I would prefer if Mr. Chairman could maybe have time to let at least the Labor Commissioner look the bill over now that it's amended before we pass it out. Just 2 days, 3 days.
Yeah, Dale Ward from Bureau of Labor contacted me. He was going to be here today. I don't know if it's going to be late or what, but the Bureau of Labor has reviewed the amendments and said that they would be delighted to keep it. Sorry, Mr. Ward isn't here.
I see him here. Yeah, well, why don't we just slip this one down at the end of today's agenda? Certainly, I'm going to take the administrative assistant to word for it, that the Bureau of Labor has been able to see it. But if Mr. Ward would come in, and we'll give him the opportunity to react one way or the other today. So let's just put that down at the tail end of our agenda for today, shall we? Okay, let's move on to the next bill, State Employees Board 2448. We have some amendments on that. We have some amendments dated April 23rd. These amendments just do what I guess you can. All right. Make them part of the collective bargaining. Okay, I see that. Okay, if you'll just to refresh your memory, tad bit on House Bill 2448. I don't know that.
Yeah, the train got low, and Mr. Chairman's passed it. I just had a heart attack there for a second.
All right. No, I think it slowed down a little bit. House Bill 2448, as you'll recall, was the request by Oregon State Employees Association that there be elected by the state employees in election four persons to serve on the Personnel Division and Executive Department, Employee Benefits, State Employees Benefit Board. Representative Wilhelms and I had a marvelous idea, and the marvelous idea was to do away with the Employees Benefit Board and make it a matter of collective bargaining, and pass that idea on to Ways and Means, and they didn't agree with it at this session. It was a very good idea for some reason or another. So I would suggest the amendment that you see April 23rd. The amendments stated on April 23rd would say that the people that were appointed on the Employee Benefit Board who are state employees had to be members of the collective bargaining unit. In other words, saying that if you're going to have members on the Employee Benefit Board and decide what the state employee benefit is going to be, it's got to be people that are involved, or at least members of the unit that are involved in the collective bargaining.
It could be employees.
Sure, employees that are covered, that's right, not administrators or some other middle management executive staff. And that's all that it does. I believe it puts two on immediately and two grandfathered in. All right, that's section two. Notwithstanding section one, the state employee representative means qualifications shall be appointed effective July 1, 75, and then two in July 1, 76. So basically that's what it does. It deletes some of the other parts of the bill that said they'll be elected by the state employees. Thank you, Representative Wyatt. Representative Wyatt moves the amendment dated April 23rd to House Bill 2448. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Gilmore?
Representative
Hammond?
Aye.
Representative Wilhelm?
Aye.
Representative Wyatt?
Aye.
Representative Hammond?
Aye. Motion passes.
All right. Representative Wyatt moves House Bill 2448. To the floor of the due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Yeah, Representative Simpson.
Say those two shall be appointed by the executive office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of the election process. That seemed to me, at best, a very difficult situation, but certainly costly. And I thought that if we just included them this time as part of the collective bargaining unit, that maybe the next time Representative Wilhelms and I could get our way and maybe do away with the board and say that it's a matter of collective bargaining. That's just my thought.
What's wrong with middle management?
Well, they're not part of the unit, that's all. It seems to me if somebody's deciding the benefits for the unit, it ought to be somebody that's involved in the unit in collective bargaining. Nothing wrong with middle management people, myself being one.
My best friend is
right.
Well, I just
think I'm sorry, that was not meant to be a derogatory remark. Some of the most ambitious people I know, Representative Wilhelms, are middle management people. Is that there?
You hit their head with the channel in the right direction.
Touche. All right. Clerk, call roll.
Representative Gilmore.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. And Dan Moore, would you like to share that, Joe?
Certainly.
And endear you to the OSCA before they set up a stick line.
One last shot.
House Bill 2688, air rifles. Now, we have a report on that from Ms. Kinsey.
I've been in contact with representatives of the Department of Education, and they as yet do not have a final reply. But tentatively, what we've come up with is that the Department of Education will work with the Wildlife Commission to come up with a curriculum designed for elementary school, Department of Physical Education class, and that they would, when it's developed, the Department of Education would make it available to school districts. The other option would be, once it is developed, to require school districts to implement it. The suggestion from Mannheim was that we merely make it available and wait till next session to see how many are using it. And if further action is needed, maybe make it mandatory next time. I hope by Wednesday. She just had to check it out with her.
Do we need a bill?
No.
I think you need a bill.
Okay.
The chairman should take one. Yeah, the chairman should write a letter.
I don't know. What chairman?
Representative Hammond.
I had the thought when we heard this bill last time that parental financial responsibility for property damage or bodily injury created by persons under a certain age, 14 or 12 or something, and notification of that provision being placed with the sale of each such item in the state of Oregon might put parents on notice that they are responsible for broken windows and eyes shot out. And I was just wondering if we could maybe project any safety while we have the bill here. I know that there's some disagreement. I talked to one of the persons interested in like that parental responsibility thing. For some reason or another. But I thought it was a pretty good idea. I don't know what the rest of the committee thinks or how long it would take to draft amendments saying that parents are responsible for.
Aren't they currently responsible, Representative Hammond?
Under vandalism, you mean, and so on?
I kind of wonder. I think that if a youngster shot out another youngster's eye, that the parents would be responsible.
I'm sure the law doesn't probably specifically say a fine up to such and such for shooting out the eye of a neighbor, whereas, of course, they could go to court and have it out.
I like your idea of notification and that. Included with all of the air rifles that
I don't think it would boggle the retailers too much to have a standard form printed by the same people we're giving the educational thing to, the Wildlife Commissioner Education. Let them prescribe a little thing that says this gun is dangerous if certain and such, and require the law that it be placed within the package or distributed at the time the sale is made to a person under 14.
Requiring some kind of notice when a BB gun or whatever sold it, they have to include a statement as to financial responsibility.
Financial responsibility.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Good.
Does that sound reasonable to the other members of the committee, Representative Williams?
I don't like the bill.
Representative Simpson? Hmm? Pardon?
I don't like the bill at all. I'm in favor of the table.
I'm just wondering, Representative Simpson, how to get at that problem, since it appears to be a problem.
Take the bill.
Well, that would delete all of that bill to do that.
Yeah.
How about those particular amendments, which would, in fact, be putting a new bill in?
Yeah,
about the rest of the committee, Rep. Sam Desmore? That seemed like a lot of work. Yeah, I was trying to get an idea whether or not we ought to go that route or not.
My suggestion would be to perhaps use the bill as some kind of a liability notice as Representative Hannum has suggested and write a letter to the Department of Education to accomplish
the other part. That seems like a logical way to go. Representative Gilmore, would you concur with that?
I concur with Max Simpson.
You just can table it.
Well, we're asking for a poll, that's my thing.
I think that the witness who spoke in opposition on the gun control issue indicated the parental responsibility thing was okay with him. I thought so that.
Yeah, I recall that. Right. All right.
Point.
Mr. Representative.
Thank you.
Safety program is a little different standpoint, I think, from the standpoint that in order to get a license to go hunting, you have to take a hunter safety program. So it becomes an incentive to go ahead and complete the program. Whether it's difficult to, or will be difficult to measure the incentive for going ahead and completing the program and finding out how to use that particular kind of a firearm. I think your other point, Representative Simpson, is well taken, that a lot of youngsters pick up 22 pistol or whatever, some other firearm, haven't taken a hunter safety course and do exactly the same thing, only much more damage. And I'm not sure what the answer to that problem is. All right, we'll defer any action on that bill then at this time. And I'll have some amendments prepared then on liability responsibility. And then also I'll write a letter to the Board of Education.
Very good.
All right. Barber's House Bill 2286. That, as you'll recall, is the bill that would provide any money for the public members on the Barber Board.
That's the table, Bill. I would move that the House Bill 2286 be pulled from the table.
Representative Gilmore moves that House Bill 2286 be taken from the table. Discussion?
Representative Wyatt. It's in this book.
All right. First, call it all. Oh, excuse me, Representative Simpson. 22.
Barber's budget bill.
C bill
for Barber.
Still goes to Ways and Means, yeah.
Sure does. Oh. Yes, sir. I must have a table section. I go down here.
That is a table section.
No, it's back, but it's a red tab. The green tab must be a go tab. Or no, orange tab is go tab. And we don't have a green tab. And orange is caution. Red is danger. We've done pretty well. All right. Further discussion on taking 2286 off the table?
Question.
Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion passed. Well, you've got one right in here.
Two public members
is what we're buying with this.
I'd move the amendment, Mr. Chairman, to untable House Bill 2286.
Have we already done that?
No.
Oh, okay. Representative Gilmore moves the amendment to House Bill 2286. I guess simply known as amendment. There's inscribed across the top to identify the amendment. The handwritten number 2286.
Discussion?
Yes. Representative Hamm.
There's a second sheet in mine too with a different fee schedule. And it has no.
I think it has no bearing on. I don't know what you have.
The one we're voting on in sub 5 should be $15 and $20.
The rounded number takes a
rounded number.
Right.
Ways and Means says the computer doesn't like it.
Well, the fee schedule is different. I don't, oh, I see. They don't like the 15, 75, 25.
Yeah, they don't like it.
Well, it's a little difference between $12.50 and $15, you know, if you're going to round them off to the nearest dollar.
Well, these are just maximum. They can still set it at $12.50.
Yeah. Okay. I think they ought to see what the computer does. Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll. Representative Grinnell voted aye also. Motion passed.
Chairman?
Representative Dinsmore.
Move amended 2286 to waive the major tax.
All right. Representative Dinsmore moves the amended House Bill 2286 to waive the meeting committee with due pass recommendation.
Okay, essentially all that's in the bill then is the fee schedule and the public members, is that right?
Public members is in another bill.
Another bill. Harry Barber is going to get an increase to cover the public members.
Right. Mm-hmm. If Wade means their wisdom so deeply.
Oh, yeah.
Never know what they might think that. Further discussion. Clerk, call roll. Codes for moved buildings. Recall that a number of people move buildings, but it's difficult for them to comply with current building codes. It's not impossible. And that's exempt them.
At the last hearing, nobody testified in favor.
Huh?
Yeah. So Betty is here today.
Betty, would you have a few comments? We'll take a few, even though this is not a hearing. The reason is because the chairman's supportive of the bill.
Right.
Okay, that's well, a notice of conflict all at the same time.
3003 is before you because at the present time, if people follow the state code, if the cost of rehabilitating a structure is more than half its value, it then has to comply with new construction standards. And this is often quite unnecessary. It's an old rule of thumb. It's been around a long time. At the time that it was first instigated, it was a case of really being more economical to build something new than to keep something old if you were going to put that much into it. With the extreme rise in the cost of new construction, not to mention our consciousness of the desirability of not tearing down everything old and replacing it with something new, this becomes an unfortunate regulation. It's my understanding that the ICBO, the International Building Official, who put out the UBC housing code, building code, are contemplating changing the regulation, recognizing themselves that it doesn't make too much sense anymore. However, they haven't done that yet. And in the meantime, there are about 1,000 homes a year being moved in Oregon, probably a lot of them illegally in the sense that they are not following the state regs, but we ought to make it legal and we ought to encourage them to be moved rather than discouraging them. And so what this amendment does is to allow them to be moved and to meet the safety and health standards, but not necessarily be brought up to present construction code. And if you want examples of the kinds of things that are involved when you say that you'll meet health and safety standards, but not necessarily the current code, you get into things like the fact that at the time the building was built, sheathed wiring may have been acceptable. Now under new construction, perhaps they're requiring that you put the wiring through a conduit. I say perhaps these things do change, but in any event, the essence of it would be that if the wiring is safe, if it's still sheathed, or if the sheathing can be replaced, then you don't go in and rip everything out and put in all the wiring in the conduit, thereby raising the cost by umpteen dollars. Greg Smith called my attention to the fact that in the little town of Bates in eastern Oregon, which is being inundated, there are about 500 people.
I want to get you in trouble there. It's the fact that they're just moving.
Thank you. I wasn't sure after I said that whether that was right. Yes. They're moving the mill. They're buying their houses from Heinz Lumber Company for $1 a piece. And it costs them maybe $1,000 or $2,000 to move them to John Day or Prairie City, and another couple thousand to get hooked up onto the sewer. Well, now clearly they then need to go ahead and get them restored to usable, and we wouldn't want to limit them to being able to spend $2,000 on them when if they had to comply with new construction codes, they'd be up into many thousands. So there, and there are many such instances, and many instances of houses that did not get kept because of the restriction as it had existed and was applied in places that had very strict enforcement codes. We had to make this kind of a change in the code in Eugene 2 years ago. We found the highway department houses were going to sell.
Representative White?
A couple questions.
They don't fit in one way or another because they're not covered by this particular kind of code.
Also, three or four days ago on the floor, either passed or concurred the Senate amendment for recast, a bill allowing local political subsidies to petition the rest of the Department of Commerce to opt out of building code requirements or seek.
You mean Representative Patterson's bill?
I think so.
Did you pass that one?
Mm-hmm.
You mean the one that says they can opt out, but if they opt out, they ain't got nothing? Or did that get amended in committee?
It was amended in
committee.
Oh,
no.
It's an application.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
I know, I haven't seen the amendments. I talked to Representative Patterson about the bill some time ago because I was very curious about why he had introduced it. It was a very odd bill. I haven't seen it, so I don't know what's in it, and I don't know how likely it is to go through the other side. I would conjecture that this is perhaps a more directly to the point, Bill. I don't think that anybody should have to make a stand to apply. I think that all local governments should have the information that this is the route they can go. But we do still involve, as the amended version shows, that there be an appropriate building inspection authority involved.
Other questions?
The local building inspector would do this. They are quite accustomed to recognizing those and identifying them as distinct from other kinds of changes that might be required under some code.
I'd be happy to
move the amendment. Representative White would be happy to move the amendment, and so thereby is to House Bill 3003. Is there any questions? Comments? Discussion? Clerk Caldwell.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passed.
All right.
Representative Dinsmore.
Certainly. The first two lines of section 2, what
do
they mean?
So they refer to the fact that the building code says that if the cost of rehabilitation exceeds 50% of the value of the structure, then it shall have to, the state building code provision shall have to apply. So this makes the exception from what the state code says.
Well, you need to really say that.
I'm almost wondering, it might not be better draftsmanship, and I had the same question. It might not be better draftsmanship simply to say that portion of ORS is amended, saying that state building code provisions shall not be applied to existing buildings, because really what that's saying is, regardless of what it says, that's what it's going to be.
I'm troubled by the drafting.
Did Legislative Council draft these amendments?
No. The Legislative Council approved the drafting of the amendments, and they based them on, in part at any rate, on the definition of substantial compliance that was introduced into House Bill 2342, which has been passed in the House, and in which this concept was introduced because it was obvious that otherwise we were not going to get any rehabilitation occurring under that bill.
We wanted this in there because this was the basis on which the code is being applied. It is.
All right. Who can legislate the council look at me?
Paul or me.
Oh,
he drafted the original
bill. He's not here this afternoon.
He and I met Friday, and I
showed him this, and he said it looked fine.
I think it would be perfectly intelligible to all building inspectors who are familiar with the rule of thumb.
In other words, it's saying that regardless of the fact that they had been exempted, the value was below 50%, or the value was above 50%, that regardless of that, all buildings anyway would be. You know, it almost seems to me that you ought to repeal the 50% provision because you're saying that all buildings being moved no longer are subject to code. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't think you want to do that because we've also got this provision, you see, with respect to buildings that are not being moved in 2342. It applies to buildings that are being rehabilitated, whether moved or staying in the same place. But now we are saying...
Fine. Now it makes sense to me.
See? So we're trying to make a consistent statement about all the circumstances in which we may have exceptions.
All right. Further questions?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Charlie Rose. I'm from the Chief Deputy of the State Fire Marshal's Office. I'm a little concerned about this from a fire protection standpoint. It looks like this is a permissive action. It kind of discriminates against the person who's going to build a new building. In contrast, the fellow who wants to move a building, he's not going to be subject to any rules. And if he's going to build a new building, he'd be subject to all the rules of the building code. And aren't we addressing ourselves here now to dwellings? Isn't this what the problem is?
But fire is an exception. The fire still has to be dealt with. The fire standards have got to be met no matter
who
what.
Who and when is this going to be determined? This looks to me like it's, the building is going to be moved and it's going to be set up in the foundation and they're all going to be into it. And then maybe the fire people get their ass in the back.
Subsection 2 says nothing in section is intended to permit any person to move a structure unless they first consult with appropriate building inspection authority, obtains all necessary or all required permits. So in other words, the process as I understand it as I read the amendment, is the person intending to move the building would then go and get a building permit. And the building permit then, the building inspector would determine whether or not there was a hazard in regards to the structure, fire, health, or life safety hazards in that building. If there were, then he'd require that person to comply with the necessary code to take care of the problem. If there weren't, then he'd go ahead and say, we'll go ahead and move the building and put it on that foundation. We'll go ahead and maybe even in some parts of that, some parts would apply to the fire hazard. They say, well, that's a fire hazard, you can't do that, you have to correct this. But the other things are all right. The fact that the studs are 18 and 3/4 inches on center doesn't matter to us, or the fact that they used rough size 2x3 studs when they built the building in 1804, that doesn't matter to us. But what does matter to us is it's got to be safe as far as fire. And
that's
what
I agree with. You need to look at the amendment, sir. No wonder you're saying,
well, I haven't seen it yet. One other question. As I asked before, is this applicable to dwelling units? I mean, is this what it's intended to apply to?
That's what I think.
Don't you think that should be stated in the code? I mean, in the bill? Because here, take all buildings. We could go down here and move anything without a permit. I think maybe...
It
ought
to have a permit.
What's that?
They still have to have a permit no matter what.
I know, but you want this to apply so that anybody can move any building. They move the Presbyterian church down here from one place to another location.
Sure.
Why not?
Sure. I don't want to build a new Presbyterian church. What if Representative Simpson wants to move a barn? Would that be all right? If the barn was structurally all right, as long as it wasn't unsafe, move it.
If you don't believe it, you don't believe it in the moving process from the original position to the final location, a lot of things can happen with this building in that transition. And I think it should be subjected to a permit and inspection.
It will be, Chairman.
As I understand his amendment, that's what would happen.
Yeah, I talked to the building code people this morning, and you have to get what's called a moving permit. And you have to meet all sorts of things, and you have to get your route approved, and the foundation on the new place, and they inspect it before they move it, while they're moving it, and after it's set up. And that will still apply.
Okay, Representative Densmore?
I would hope that the remarks made just by the gentleman who's interpreting what we do in this legislative assembly and past legislative assembly would not be indicative of a bias against moving buildings and in favor of building new ones, because it seems to me as we watch the cost of building new buildings go out of sight, we're going to have to make accommodations like this one in order to allow people to have a place to live at a reasonable cost. And it seems to me that subsection 2 is an adequate safeguard that all existing permits will still have to be complied with.
Mr. Chairman, are these amendments acceptable to the committee and ready to go?
Yes, I have moved the amendment.
Okay.
We
we've just adopted the amendment to 2003, and I share Representative Denmore's concern. I may just enter into the record my remarks that, because I've seen this so many, many times, of old buildings that would have been better served had they been moved rather than demolished. And matter of fact, far superior materials in those buildings, and you can even procure today, being destroyed and replacing it with a structure that couldn't compare as far as material or even in any respect construction. The quality of construction, the craftsmanship, which you can't get these days because you can't afford the labor costs to require that kind of construction. Any further discussion?
Question.
Let's see, we have a motion. I forgot that. Representative Hanneman moves that House Bill 3003 to the floor of the two-pass recommendation as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes. I've had enthusiasm all my life for a bill.
We're talking about
the
little
one
off the left, or a white woman.
Oh, is that who sponsored?
Probably the first and only.
That
was
put it on the unanimous consent. What? Yeah, we should. Really? I think so. I'll put it on unanimous calendar. And Representative Wyatt, would you do the explanation on it, please?
Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, all right. Gail, I didn't see him here. He's that side, satisfying his nicotine habits. Part of the record. All right. Welcome to the deal. Question arose, we adopted some amendments to House Bill 2465. Is Representative Gilmore out in the hall? All right. I think this was his question. And the question was how the Bureau of Labor would react to the amendments in respect to having that enforcement placed in their hands, or that is, investigation of those kind of complaints placed in their hands. The ultimate responsibility then boiling down, I suppose, the OLCC as to the revocation or suspension of a license.
Mr. Chairman, Dale Ward, Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor. If I understand the concern, is the situation such that the liquor commissioner may suspect discrimination and therefore request the Labor Commissioner or the Bureau of Labor to conduct an investigation and make a determination? Is that the essence of that amendment?
That's as I understand the amendment, Chair.
We would have absolutely no objection to that at all, Mr. Chairman, and we would not see any need for any increase in staff for that purpose. The number of cases that would be involved where it was an establishment that had a liquor license would be very few in the first place. So the impact as far as on our staff would be negligible.
I see. So then, now that was a suggestion, by the way, the possibility may not have been referred to Ways and Means. You could do that with your current staff or the anticipated staff that's in the current budget or the budget that's being anticipated for the next fiscal year.
I'm certain of that.
All right.
Ways and Means Committee was very sympathetic to our needs, and we feel quite comfortable with the next biennium and should be able to handle that without any difficulty. We are, by the way, Mr. Chairman, in favor of the bill. We chose not to testify for the simple reason of priority in terms of other bills and time.
Mr. Ward, one of the concerns I had during the interim, and that was not under the current commissioner, but was under the former commissioner, was the kind of job, or the, actually I'm going to be straightforward about it, the lack of what I thought the kind of a job, the appropriate job that the Bureau of Labor was doing in respect to being able to investigate and taking appropriate action in discrimination cases. Has the current commissioner asked for an increase of people in that division or in that department of the Bureau to be able to take care of or beef up or even perhaps better manage the investigatory process that was going on there?
Allowing me a bit of a digression, which may be a digression, but I'm interested that most legislators have. I can speak to that in just a couple of minutes. Number one, we have made some significant changes in the management and the processing of complaints that are filed within the Bureau. To the extent that we will no longer have a backlog in investigation by the end of June 30th of this year. Our backlog at the time that the new commissioner came in was over 600 cases. At the present time, all cases that have been filed with the Bureau of Labor are assigned to an investigator, which means that they are active. By June 30, we will be in a position to instead of having 18 months elapsed from the date a complaint is filed to the time that it begins investigation, it will be 10 days. So we expect to
set in an addition in staff or simply reorganization?
Primarily reorganization. Some relatively simple but very basic changes that needed to be made in the policy and the procedures that were used to handle complaints. We made those changes and the turnaround was immediate. So we were telling Ways and Means that the request for manpower that we were making for the next biennium were based on a current operation with no backlog. We intend to meet that, and we intend to be current, and by current I mean a case filed and assigned within 10 days.
Further questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilhelm.
Well, I just say I don't have any other questions. I got a question on the bill.
All right.
I think there's a technical problem.
All right.
That being that in the subsidy of section 2, there are no definitions in this bill. This bill is 471 and 72 of the liquor statutes, aren't they?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah, well, it says the commissioner. Now, the intent of the amendment is the labor commissioner, but you pass this law, you're going to be talking about the liquor control commission, I think, or somebody else. And
I read the, if I might respond.
Yes,
Mr. Ward. I read the amendments and I had the same immediate question. I suspect because the language refers to the suspension or issuance of a license that they are referring to the liquor commissioner. Might not hurt to have that kind of clarification.
Okay.
Sure. All right.
I've been
Representative Wyatt.
4 or 5 times in the agency's title and Jermaine has looked back in that village.
But creating new provisions, any kind of title to creating new provisions in pretty good shape. Much better shape than it said relating to alcohol or liquor license amendments without creating new provisions. But this man just said liquor control commissioner. That was my understanding. That's your understanding at this point. When the amendments were proposed, we're talking about the labor commission.
Hey,
the intent of the amendment is it's the labor commissioner, but a man from the labor commissioner's office says that he's talking about the labor commissioner. I think there's some confusion around here.
It doesn't have to be edited. The, that was the intent that the labor commissioner would investigate and that the OLCC commissioner would refuse to issue or suspend.
That was my understanding, and after reading it, that's the conclusion I had to come to.
There is, there is no OLCC commissioner.
There is a commission.
Okay.
There are three of them.
The section 2 is added to and made a part of the Bureau of Labor Law. Commissioner in these amendments means the labor commissioner.
Right.
There is, so this would have to be revised to say the commissioner may recommend to the Bureau of Labor that.
No, the commissioner may recommend to the
Bureau of Labor. I mean, yes, to the office. And I will get Kathleen to.
That does an editorial comment. It appears to me that these amendments are just being proposed to kind of maybe make the people feel that this bill isn't dead. And we are confusing the thing beyond belief, in my own opinion. And on the first line of section 2, where it says on complaint or on his own motion, we at that point then are enabling the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor to move in. Well, it would have got to be considered liquor-related violations.
Sure.
And it does not appear to me to make good sense that we involve the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor in liquor affairs.
Sure. Representative Wyatt.
I think clearly we've dealt briefly with the subject before with respect to every other agency of government and privilege bestowed by government. Recollection from our staff experience, the subcommittee that dealt with those, the Bureau of
you in any effect, except that you're operating on basic premises. There's some sort of discrimination that exists, and I don't want to bring that around.
No.
I have an all male or all female organization to be a non-discriminatory.
Well, that's all you're saying is you're opposed to pass up the bill.
Well, yeah, I always have been, but I think this bill, after it's going to pass, is worse than it was in the president's first one.
Well, in any event, gentlemen, we're not going to take any action on the bill today. I have some suggested amendments that I'll have you look at that McKenzie's worked over on the bill, and I think perhaps they speak to one your concern, Representative Wilhelm, and certainly clarify the language as far as whose jurisdiction we're talking about. And I'll tell you what I'll do before our Wednesday meeting. We'll just prepare these amendments and circulate them before the meeting so you have some opportunity to look at them before the meeting. And then maybe we can take some action.
That would be great. I appreciate it.
All right. Would you like that?
Yes, I would.
All right. That's what Chair is going to decide. Thank you, Mr. Warden. Okay. Well, now move on to 2624. 2624, I left the room. I had to meet with the Speaker last time. We were talking about Ombudsman, and I believe the comment by Representative Denthorne, I don't know. I'm just speaking from what I think was said at the meeting. If I'm incorrect, you can correct me, Representative Denthorne. But we like the way it's operating now. Let's leave it. And some people concurred, some people said, well, we don't like it, or whatever, nothing was done. The fact of the matter is, if we don't take some action on an ombudsman or an ombudsperson one way or the other, there very likely won't be one, because the past has been an extra creation of the previous executive, and so now there needs to be a determination if there's going to be a continuation of an ombudsperson, whether or not it ought to be included in the statute. And then the decision being that if it is going to be included, whether or not it ought to be under the decision of the executive to choose it, or whether it ought to be under the legislature to choose it. And that's all I'm bringing to you, is the proposition that has been pointed out to me by the leadership, that there ought to be some decision made one way or the other, no decision. And so I bring that to you once more, simply for discussion and attempt to get some consensus. And if the consensus is no, we don't want to take any action, then I guess that's fine too.
If the present executive didn't believe in the concept of an ombudsperson, he wouldn't have appointed one. And it seems to me that with that support, that office is going to continue. No matter what you call it, that function, as I said before, is going to be performed by someone on the staff. And I, for the life of me, can't get excited about the legislature getting involved in what seems to me is an executive function.
I suppose the only thing that's brought to me was the fact that everyone's going to recognize the existence of one, that perhaps it ought to exist statutorily.
There's currently no authorization for the ombudsman to have any kind of power at all.
Yeah.
And yet, and on the same token, there are no limitations to the power. So other than just the fact that she works for the governor, there's nothing that compels any state agency to cooperate with the ombudsman.
Except that the governor's office will come down upon your head.
Right on. It's all in the executive department. He makes the appointments. There can't be any greater power to those bureaucrats than the guy that appoints.
Which appointment? That would be a hard one. Are you saying we ought to leave it the way it is, then?
Well, the way it is, it doesn't exist as far as law goes. As far as the statute goes, let's just say.
How long has there been an
ombudsman? I believe
Governor McCall
started.
69 or 71. 69, I believe, or between 69 and 71.
There's never been a statutory office like that. There's never been a social budget. Yet, from everyone that I've been getting out of, my current position is usually pretty effective. They seem to be having one next. I really don't accept the there is sufficient authority, I think, because it does exist within the governor's office. I think the current situation seems to be working very well. I don't see why we need to bless it. What we do isn't going to make any difference unless we clearly take it out of the governor's office. Quite frankly, I think it's worth it. Properly this place where it is, and there are no doubt going to find money if they deem it desirable. On the other hand, the only action we could take that would have any substantial impact would be to take it from the executive department and place it under the auspices legislative administration or leadership somehow. Otherwise, if we statutorily recognize the place in the governor's office, it's probably going to run just about like it is right now. And so I think that's the only decision we have, so whether or not we're going to pull it out and make the whole athletic curriculum. And I don't care for that.
There's a possibility that next session when the governor comes in and says, I want X dollars for a staff of three, but he owns it in the way the news committee would say.
There isn't.
No, you don't have any statutory authority, you're not going to give it to
the staff. Has the governor ever requested money to be on this person before?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman,
it breaks out to a staff decision. The governor says, I need shot to shot numbers of people in order to run my office. And so the way the Means Committee accepts it, doesn't accept it, funds it at whatever level, and bang, he has assistants. Now, one of those persons I maintain will be some kind of ombudsperson, even if we don't pass this bill. And that function is going to be performed.
If the governor has a commitment to it, and if he doesn't, passing the bill isn't going to make any difference because it's pretty darn tough.
Now move on to House Bill 2652. There's no compelling argument to say at the other one, and I certainly hope that you gentlemen, your judgment, made the right judgment. I'm certain you'll probably be hearing about it. 2652, Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir.
Can I just make a comment, please?
Certainly may.
It would be just an overall, just philosophical point that I have used the office, you know, for not just all personal matters. But I've used there a great many times since the session started. I'm trying to see the most cooperative group in the entire area. And I think they're doing a marvelous job. And I really believe that if this is to be run the same way that the other office of ombudsman is concerned, then we should take a real good look at this. I think this is a marvelous thing that we can't get all without, really. And that's just my philosophical view.
Well, that's kind of the chair's feeling, that it's doing a fine job or has done a fine job in the past. And it's been pointed out to me that perhaps because of that, it should exist statutorily in order to receive the support and funding that it may need in the future. And by no means meant to be an inroad into who selects it or how it's selected. And if it was the wisdom of this committee that it should be selected as it currently is by the appointment of the governor, then so be it. So, I think that there's no support, apparently, by the majority of the members of this committee, which is four votes we need to have,
Mr. Chairman,
in order to do anything. Possibly. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. We'll wait.
All right.
We'll wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Look at it from another point of view. But I agree with your sentiments exactly, Representative. Yes, sir. Representative Gilmore.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to House Bill 2652, Legislative Council Amendment, dated 42375, number 14.
Representative Gilmore moves the amendment stated 42375, Legislative Council, to House Bill 2652.
Mr. Chairman.
Discussion. Representative Hammond.
Amend the motion to remove the word may in both places where it is inserted in long end.
Representative Hanneman moved to amend the amendments to delete may where it appears on page 1 and page 2 of the amendment.
Okay. I'll accept that as part of my motion, Mr. Chairman.
So you have.
Would you wait a moment?
Yeah. Certainly will. You have.
I haven't found the bill yet.
Okay. In the bill are two sets of proposed amendments, one proposed by the City of Portland. Dated 42375, and another set of amendments dated are set to be from Legislative Council 42375. And the motion is to amend first to adopt the amendments and then to amend the motion to delete May,
which
was Legislative Council's amendment.
Okay.
And Section 2 May would be deleted out of on page 1 and on page 2, Section 4 May.
Restoring the S on the end of the
group
go along.
I assume that's true.
Well,
discussion on your motion, Representative Hammond.
There are a couple of hundred bills in this session which would tend to increase the rates to utility users through legislative actions, and this is one that tends to give them, I think, a fair consideration in the case concerning housing authorities. And so I strongly urge the committee to favorably consider them.
Chair is going to pose a motion to amend, and the reason being that it was thought that this was a negotiation kind of a process, and because it was a negotiation process, and the eventual arbiter in the event of a dispute would be the Public Utility Commissioner, it would seem to me that if you say include in your specific what the costs are going to be, that there really isn't any negotiation that goes on. As a matter of fact, in any case, it would be referred immediately to the Public Utility Commissioner, I suppose, if everybody said, well, I don't think the costs are, that is the public authorities that I don't think the cost of replacement, etc., are whatever they are, and the public utility or the private utility would argue. So for that reason, I'm going to oppose the amendment, the May amendment, because I think May then says they may include that in the event that the negotiators feel that they don't have to include that, then they wouldn't have to.
They could include more than that.
Could possibly include more than that, whatever the negotiations were involved.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would support the, let's see, it reads as an amended motion to adopt the end. I think in this particular case we have to be more certain than that, so I support the motion to remove the name.
Well, my only argument to that would have been the fact that you've already said fair and reasonable compensation. And I don't know what determined that. Then gives two determinations to the Public Utility Commissioner. The first determination as an arbiter that he'd have to make is whether the compensation was fair and reasonable, and the second was whether or not the cost of replacement with similar facilities and installation like salvage was in fact fair and reasonable or actual. I'm not sure if actual and fair and reasonable are necessarily the same. That seems to be a problem in my mind.
Well, looking at the voting amendment,
from a vote on the first, the motion to amend. I represent Gilmore's motion. Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll. His, which would have deleted May, Representative Hanlon's amendment deleting May, and the language amendment, which includes the cost of. We're on the motion to adopt the amendment as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
No.
No. Representative Hanlon.
Will we send 2652 to the floor to pass the amendment?
Representative Hammond moves House Bill 2652 to the floor with due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion. I'll make one last plea in the case of what is fairness and equity involving negotiations. And it seems to me that you can't negotiate fair and reasonable compensation, which is fair and reasonable in the mind of two parties. When you include a set of prerequisites that they must follow. It seems to me that if a public utility or private utility says the cost of replacement of the same or similar facilities and the installation thereof cost such and such, there's no room to negotiate. And if that's the case, then very well maybe I would strike subsection 2 as far as the Public Utility Commissioner arbitrating, because there isn't anything for him to arbitrate because these are pre-established costs. Now I'm going to vote against the motion to send the floor. Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
No.
Count 4-3. Motion passed.
notice of possible minority report.
Representing Dennis Morgan's notice of possible minority report on House Bill 2652. Representative Gilmore, would you like to carry House Bill 2652 on the floor?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Unless somebody wants to carry it.
Anyone else would like to carry it?
I'd love to carry it.
I'm Representative Dennis Moore Wider for now.
I'll carry it.
Hammond, you're the sponsor. That's
the sponsor.
What are you?
Those Wyatt and Darrell and
Dennis.
I have bills changed.
Well, who would like to?
I would suggest it.
All right, you two decide and let me know. All right.
Chairman, could you include in there a request that my name be taken off the bill?
Request in the committee report. Representative Dennis Moore's name. And Grinnell.
We'll have to ask for that.
We'll have to ask for that.
But it only takes a motion if you remember.
Okay, let's go to House Bill 2830.
The warranty for mobile homes, and it was set aside because there was testimony that there was federal legislation or a federal administrative rule coming up that would require mobile home warranty, and that this state action would not be necessary. The reason it's on the agenda, Betty Niven, who was a representative of the National Mobile Home Advisory Council, went to Washington, D.C. last week at a meeting, and at the very end of the meeting, it was announced that the federal mobile home warranty was not going to be in effect after all.
So, Ms. Niven, would you like to join the committee and tell us what you found out? First question I'll ask you is, how are the flowers? Are they still lovely back there?
Yeah, pretty good. I understand they lost their cherry blossoms in one day, however.
2 weeks ago, the azaleas were lovely. Yeah. Are they still out, all the azaleas and those things?
It was really very nice there.
Yeah,
it was nice in Oregon while you were gone.
Wasn't
it?
That's good.
Well,
thank you.
Oh, all right. Hey, thank you. Let the record show that was the remarks of the chairman of the committee. Representative Gilmore.
Out of curiosity, didn't we pass a mobile home warranty?
Instruction book.
Instruction book,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Okay. Ms. Niven, why don't you tell us why we need this bill? Now, did we table it? Or is it
no, I think it just set it aside without any action.
All right.
And I would like to say that since I talked to Ms. Kinsey last week, I did check again with people in Washington, D.C., and the present state of affairs is this, that the Federal Trade Commission did issue some regulations which have never gone through the Federal Register publication process, and the manufacturers asked them to withhold any issuance of these regulations until such time as the National Mobile Home Safety Standards were established, because there, on the face of it, was a conflict between the FTC regulations and what was required under the 1974 Community Development Act, which would make it impossible for manufacturers to comply both ways. So there is nothing in existence now, and will not be, presumably, until we have settled the half with the construction, with the National Mobile Home Construction Standards. The thing that was brought home to me strongly when I was in Washington, D.C. was that so far as any as federal enforcement of standards are concerned, that they are primarily going to function at the level of the manufacturer. There is not anything in mind in terms of the Mobile Home Administration, setting aside the Federal Trade Commission, that would deal at all with what happens with a mobile home from the time it has left the manufacturer until it reaches the hands of the consumer. And many things can happen between the manufacturer and the consumer, most of them related to what the customer does or doesn't know about how a mobile home was engineered and whether it will or will not withstand being moved to a different location in terms of how it was built for snow load and how it was built for wind resistance. And inasmuch as these are the kinds of things that have gotten mobile homes into difficulty and have not have done nothing to improve their image, it seems to me that it would be very wise for the state of Oregon to adopt a warranty program, and I have submitted amendments to the 2830, which are not inconsistent, I might say, with the amendments that were submitted by Ken Johnson the last time we had a hearing. I have no objection to Ken Johnson's amendments. But the ones that I am proposing are ones that all come really in the line of information to the consumer about what he can expect of this mobile home, what he better not do about moving it, unless he's moving it to the right kind of a place, and some assurance that the dealer follows the installation and tie-down instructions, because otherwise the engineering of the mobile home manufacturer isn't going to do any good at all. And a summary of the agreement between the dealer and manufacturer, which outlines the limits of responsibility of either party to the agreement. Because this, again, is where the consumer is left, perhaps, in the lurch, because the dealer says that was really the problem of what the manufacturer did. The manufacturer says, well, no, it's up to the dealer to straighten that out. And I think that the consumer is entitled to have this kind of information, and that it would be a very good idea to proceed with this act. I have assured the representative of the mobile home dealers that should we come out with marvelous federal legislation during the next 2 years, which covers all these things and which makes it unnecessary to have a duplication, I will be very happy to submit legislation 2 years from now to wipe this law off the state books so that we don't have to have it. Meanwhile, I would feel much more comfortable about the whole thing, even though I am now on the National Mobile Home Advisory Council, were we to adopt this legislation in our
questions by members of the committee? I'm trying to read. Representative Wyatt.
This conforms to statute and what the feds were going to do at one point?
The feds have got in the, and Mark probably can tell you this in much more detail than I have, what was in the FCC publication, except it wasn't basically, I mean, it wasn't published in the sense of capital published in the Federal Register. That was fairly stringent so far as requirements that repairs be made within 3 days, and that they. It is an effort to make both the dealer and the manufacturer be responsible. I don't know that it does much about sharpening whose responsibility is what, or what responsibility each of them has, and to whom the customer can should really turn if he has a complaint. But Mark,
do you think it's stiffer or?
This is not stiffer, no. I don't think so.
Mark, would you like to join in? Do you have remarks to make? First of all, why don't you answer Representative Wyatt's question, and then perhaps if he doesn't have another question or some other questions from Mrs. Niven right now, perhaps you could give us your views on this bill.
Could you redirect the question?
Two questions. One, does it apply substantially to the federal, what we at one time thought was going to be the federal act? And two, is it weaker or stronger than what we have been under the federal program?
Question number one, remember that when you talk about the federal act that Mrs. Nevin is involved with as a member of this committee, that's the new federal building code for mobile homes, the backdoor land use bill, you might say, but just remember that in that context, that's the building code. After Congress enacted that in August, the federal building code for mobile homes, Congress in December enacted the Moss-Magnuson Consumer Warranty Act, which basically says we're going to have federal law dealing with certain aspects of written warranty. It's someone like our ORS Chapter 72. The Federal Trade Commission at the same time went out and cited four mobile home manufacturers under their, in between these two laws, they went out and they cited four mobile home manufacturers for printing the documents and really not standing behind the documents. Out of that proceeding, they promulgated a trade regulation rule which covers the mobile home sale and service. In other words, who's going to take care of it, how it's going to be taken care of it, who's going to get paid. So, first of all, I disagree. I think that there's appreciable and substantial federal activity at this time, not only in the building code area, but in the warranty area, under the proposed trade regulation rule, plus the rules that they're promulgating. I think that they're going to be more restrictive from what I can see so far, and I filed 30 pages of comments with the Federal Trade Commission, and I think they're going to be more restrictive because the proposed trade regulation rule says the manufacturer built the mobile home. Since he built it, he's responsible for giving effect to the guarantees or warranties that he makes, even if he appoints a third party or a dealer to carry out that warranty.
he's still responsible for it. And I think that's a great advancement, not only because I represent dealers, because of the practical costs involved. If you can't get the parts, obviously you can't return the motorhome. Right, and it's going to have a significant effect. The Moss-Magnuson Act is going to have a significant effect on new car dealerships, because new car dealerships, they're covered by written franchises. They pencil it out there how much you're going to get an hour to repair something. But the Moss-Magnuson Act, Section 107 of it, says that there's got to be reasonable and equitable compensation to that third party for performing that warranty work. That third party is usually a dealer. So I would say that, and I'm not sure what we're using as a relative basis in saying what is more restrictive. I think the trade regulation rule in its present form, which the mobile home manufacturers, as Mrs. Nevin stated, are trying to delay and are attacking, is that, yes, I think it is more restrictive, because it places the responsibility with them and requires them to enter into some kind of agreement with their dealers or third parties to effectuate this. So, and, you know, one thing you got to be careful about is that, maybe I'm switching off from question number one, but you can put down all the laws you want on the book. You can put all the laws there you want. But if I go to negotiate for one of my dealers that he doesn't like a program or manufacturer he's going to submit to, tell him that he's going to live with, like, I think one of these amendments here require an agreement between the manufacturer and the dealer as to who's going to do what. I can tell you right now what it's going to be. It's going to be that it's going to be a unilateral, one-sided agreement. And my dealer's going to take it or leave it. By that, I mean he's either going to decide to go along with it or sell these mobile homes. And that language there would take away some of the rights that are presently afforded consumers and dealers under ORS Chapter 72, dealing with our Consumer Warranty Act. Now, I have talked all around the question, but it's very difficult to answer that question as to what is more restrictive and not what isn't more restrictive. I know that representing dealers and bosses and trying to collect money later from manufacturers, that I know that this federal legislation gives me something that I never had before. It gives me a right to reasonable compensation. It gives me a right to take them to court. The whole thrust of the Moss-Magnuson Act is get rid of lawyers in warranty disputes. Have good relationships between the seller and the manufacturer, and have a basis informal dispute procedures for consumers. That's what that thing is. And so I think it's more restrictive because, realistically, I don't know a mobile home dealer that wants to have problems with consumers, because all it winds up is legal fees. It's a disaster to him. And what he wants to do is he wants some protection somewhere for himself, like he now has under Oregon law in Chapter 72, that if the manufacturer doesn't service it, he can go service it, and he can get from the manufacturer what he can get from a retail consumer who is not entitled to warranty. He now has that. I don't know if he will have it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. You've spoken a lot of topics that I hope this session will deal with. We've got several, well, we've got two malpractice bills, and I think we deal with what comes from the professor legal fee. My answer to that is one made the bar exam and then competition for legal fee. I like that.
No, I express no comment. You didn't want to
hear that. Please be brief. I think we're going to take another session on this bill.
Yeah. You notice that all the increased restrictiveness, gentlemen, is on the manufacturer and not increased restrictions on the dealers whom Mr. O'Donnell represents. And that is exactly what came to the surface as a problem when we were in Washington, D.C., was that you can have all the inspection programs for the manufacturer that you can think of, and you can make him certify that he has built things to certain standards, but the process of setting a mobile home up on a lot is one that can undo all that was done by the manufacturer in designing it well, because it's become a cooperative thing, and it's a matter of how the dealer handles that situation, and the problem becomes one of what kind of responsibility is going to be laid on the dealer as well as on the manufacturer if the customer is going to end up with a mobile home that maintains its value. And so I don't think that, I would say that nothing that Mr. O'Donnell said has made me feel that the consumer doesn't still need some assistance as far as the dealer is concerned, and that the manufacturer isn't entitled to have some assurance that the dealer will do the right thing with his with his mobile home when he sets it up.
Mr. Chairman, a brief comment?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Hamm.
Well, I've got a couple laying on my desk right now, problems with mobile homes, and I've had a number of them over the last 6 or 8 years. I don't know, maybe we can solve some of the defects that the consumer finds in his purchase by stronger frames being put under these things so that the door shut and the plumbing works and so on when you get them set up. But you buy a home on location, a permanently fixed home, I can see where you wouldn't have the difficulty of having a transporter. But the dealer, you might answer for me, is not responsible for, in most cases, is he for the transportation of the product? He is responsible in all cases.
Yes.
The dealer is responsible in all cases for the location of the unit upon it.
He sets it up, he ties it down, it's going to be tied down. It's his baby once it's done his lot.
Well, either I think they ought to have stronger frameworks underneath them then, or else there ought to, of course, if the pad isn't sufficient then and the foundation is set upon either, then you still got trouble. I don't know how I answer these letters, though.
State administrative regs have now established some standards for setup that we didn't have before, so that should be improved. There weren't any state standards that had to be met before, so that should improve at least. But it's a very peculiar situation.
Hey, I'll give you my letters to answer for
me. Mr. Dow.
I'll be brief. I don't think Mrs. Nevin meant to state what she meant, but I don't think that, first of all, the fact that we do represent dealers and we are concerned with dealers, I think one thing that you have to remember is the manufacturer selects who's going to sell his product.
Right.
He can go out and look at this proposed dealer and say, what kind of people have you got that they're going to set up mobile homes? And Oregon law in 1973 made a great advancement. It said, when you buy a consumer product, regardless of what our Supreme Court said, regardless of what the Uniform Commercial Code says, which was drafted by bankers, they said, look, if there's something wrong with that product, the consumer can now sue not only the dealer, but he can sue the manufacturer. And the philosophy behind that was that he who selects the person to sell his product can exercise a more sophisticated degree of control over it than someone coming off the street and buying that product. And this bill here, as far as I'm concerned, really, and I can go through it point by point, which I'm sure you don't want me to.
That's right.
Really does nothing. It adds another law to it. Either the state enforces the building code for mobile homes that it has, or it's not a good building code if you're having problems with it. Adding these things to it, you couldn't even have an as-is or without all false sales. It should be in Chapter 72 if you're going to put it somewhere, and not here in the building code section or the mobile home park section of the law.
Good idea. Further questions, comments, remarks, assumptions?
I have a question.
Ms. Kennedy.
For Betty. In working up some possible further amendments to this, in the last hearing, there was testimony that this act would prevent a dealer from selling a recognized defective mobile home at a lower price. And would you object to any kind of provision that as long as it was disclosed what was wrong, that it could be?
No, I wouldn't object to that as long as it was
disclosed
about what's wrong. Not the kind of fact that seconds, right?
Ben
right. All of those things. No, he takes. That's
Chip Sink.
Well, under this bill, Representative, I'm glad you raised that example. A Chip Sink could be a requirement here that you'd have to go out and repair it. I mean, that's it's not substantial defect, it's a treatment defect.
I was going to ask that question to either Mrs. Niven or to you, Mr. McDonald, as a defect. The stud has a knot or has a pitch pocket running down if it happened to get tossed in the wall. That's a defect, isn't it? Though it may not be a substantial defect.
It doesn't say substantial, but it only says it's reasonably fit for human habitation, which seems to me to have enough caveats in it or enough space for a little room. This was drafted by the mobile home section of the Department of Commerce. It follows substantially, I think, a California law, but it was drafted by them, and it's based on their kinds of problems that they have had to deal with in consumer complaints, and presumably, from their point of view, it did have, does have some significance. I don't think that they would otherwise have drafted it. And so I do believe that it has value, and as all of you know, I am basically a friend of mobile homes, and therefore I am not out just to get anybody on mobile homes, and so I'm really, I'm sure you all are aware of this, but it's, I think it will improve.
Here, what I'd like to do, just so that everyone can have the opportunity to hear arguments for and against in their own offices from time to time between now and Wednesday, I'm in deferring action between now and Wednesday, and Wednesday again, we'll make a decision what we want to do with this bill rather than making a decision right now. And I think that will give all of us an opportunity. I'd like to have an opportunity myself to look at this a little further.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to serve notice. I'm not going to be in my office between now and Wednesday.
Okay, Representative Hammond serves notice. He's not going to be in his office between now and Wednesday.
Is anybody? I wouldn't expect that.
Representative, well, no.
We might make the ideas amendment, I guess. The ones that 10,000 already.
Anybody have any strong feeling? Maybe I ought to ask this question. Anyone have any strong feeling for the bill at this time?
No.
Does anyone have any strong feeling against the bill at this time?
Yeah.
One person. The rest of you are just kind of. We'll defer any action until Wednesday on the bill. We'll defer any action then on the bill until Wednesday. Senator 32. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. O'Donnell, Mark O'Donnell. Yeah, I know. Mark and I exchange correspondence from time to time. You know, actually, he's been exchanging more letters with Marilyn than he has with me. Senate Bill 32 is substantially like bread or whatever, I think. Whatever that has been. Well,
National
Standard for Bakery Products, and there were the amendments that in all respects conform too, because it's very difficult to set standards of identity and standards of quality of bakery products shall in all respects conform to federal standards. And of course, there was a problem of whether or not in all respects they did conform to, so it says be compatible and not in conflict with. Is that correct? Somebody, yeah, there you are, sir. Am I correct in what I said? Did we adopt the amendments the other day?
Yeah.
We did. Representative Wyatt moved Senate Bill 32 to the floor with due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion
and be put on the unanimous
and be placed on the unanimous consent calendar.
I must have missed the discussion, Mr. Chairman, but what does this bill do? It's still
and sure one,
brief,
okay,
The bill
itself, purposes of the bill.
The purpose of the bill is to delete a cross reference that came about after the 1973 Food Act was revised, which made 625.205 obsolete. So it is repealing 625.205 and putting the request that the standards of identity and standards of quality for bakery products which shall be compatible and not in conflict with the standard of identity of federal people into a different section.
Okay,
yes.
If there's a federal law, what's the need for state law? May I correct myself? Federal regulation. Well, what this amendment here is for is that we do have two special items in our bakery law, which refers to the balloon bread and to the pan sizes and to the use of enriched bread only. And in your federal regulations, you have the old white bread. So if you have to adopt the federal, you would have to change three other sections of the law to make it compatible to your federal law.
So this temporarily says the state standard shall be compatible with federal standards.
Right.
And so there doesn't have to be any substantial changes whether or not in conformity with, but compatible with federal standards.
In this compatible, sir, we would adopt the federal regulations by and omit the use of the white bread. Is what it's about what it amounts to.
I'll just give it what the reason.
Yeah.
Having state law would be if there was federal regulation. But I guess maybe that's because if it didn't have state law, then the state department agriculture couldn't be the enforcer.
True, and then you have the small bakeries within the state that the federal people do not cover, that we cover.
So the state laws expand the federal law?
Yes, yes, we, well, enhance it.
Not in line with an enhancement.
It's simply an enhancing act, as well.
I understand.
Further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Motion passed. We have some further questions on Senate Bill 349 and 421 that just occurred, and so I'm going to defer any action on those at this time. And so if there's no other business, we're adjourned.